Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to another episode of Broadway Nation, the podcast that tells the remarkable story of the Broadway musical and the immigrant Jewish, queer, and Black artist who invented it. My guest again today is author Maya Cantu, who returns to discuss her book, Grease Paint Puritan, Boston to 42nd Street in the Queer Backstage Novels of Bradford Ropes. This is the third and final part of our conversation, and today we focus on Bradford Ropes' third novel, Go Into Your Dance, which, like his previous books, 42nd Street and Stage Mother, was heavily inspired by his actual experiences as a dancer and performer on Broadway and in vaudeville during the 1920s. Maya Cantu is a dramaturg and historian who teaches on the drama faculty at Bennington College, and she's also the author of American Cinderella on the Broadway musical stage, Imagining the Working Girl from Irene to Gypsy. If you missed the first two episodes in this series, you may want to catch up with those before listening to this one. As always, I want to thank all of our Patron Club members for their generous support, with a special shout-out today to longtime members Kelly Allen and Elizabeth Troxler. If you would like to help support the creation of Broadway Nation, please stay tuned to the end of the episode, where there'll be information about how you too can become a patron. Here we go. Welcome back, Maya Cantu. It's so great to have you back again to talk about your book, Grease Paint Puritan, Boston to 42nd Street in the Queer Backstage Novels of Bradford Ropes.
Thank you, David. I'm so happy to be back.
So happy to have you. And since we had our last conversation, which was fascinating, I've been hearing from listeners about it as well, I had a chance to find and watch the movie of Stage Mother. As I said the last time, I had never seen that movie. Now I have. And it was really enjoyable. I have to say, it was a much better movie than I expected it to be.
And, you know, there's that gritty backstage narrative with Kitty Lorraine, and there's also Beautiful Girl.
Beautiful girl, you're a lovely picture. Beautiful girl, you're a gorgeous mixture of all that lies under the big blue sky. My heart cries, beautiful girl. Girl, I could never trifle if I had you. You'd be my dream come true.
Which we know from Singing in the Rain.
Exactly. That song is so familiar to us from Singing in the Rain. That's where it debuted in this MGM movie in 1933.
Well, the novel is 33. I think the film is 34. We're
34.
Kind of right at the end of the production code.
Exactly. We got by with a lot of stuff, especially, as you mentioned in the last episode, a very queer-coded character.
Mr. Sterling, yes.
Mr. Sterling, the ballet teacher.
Yes. He made it through.
He did. Somehow, he didn't get edited out along the way.
Well, you know, the thing is, I mentioned, David, that Bradford Ropes co-wrote the screenplay with another screenwriter named John Meehan. So I think the fact that he was directly on the screenplay adaptation allowed him maybe a little more freedom in keeping what he wanted to keep.
Exactly. And I noticed that there was quite a lot of the dialogue, or at least key lines from the book, at least as you quote them in your book, in the screenplay as well, that made it into the screenplay.
Yes. It's so great to have Ropes' voice so much in the screenplay, which again is pretty faithful to the book. The ending, you know, as you might expect, it's a little bit of a Hollywood ending. I don't want to give it away. The ending of the novel is not sentimental at all, but it's still, I think, a remarkably faithful adaptation of the book, which I hope comes back into print.
I do too. As we talked about, up to now it was a book and a movie I'd never seen, but now at least I've seen one of them. So I feel like I have some sense. And the parallels with Gypsy are remarkable.
Yeah, they really are. Even more so in the book, I think, but you definitely get that in the film as well. And Alice Brady is great as Kitty.
Well, and Alice Brady feels like she could have played Rose and Gypsy.
Yes, very much so.
What can I do?
But today, I want to focus on the third of the Backstage trilogy, which is Go Into Your Dance, which will relate to several other episodes of Broadway Nation. I did two terrific episodes about the person who is at the center of Go Into Your Dance, although he is given a different name and disguised a tiny, tiny bit. So who was Radford Ropes writing about in this novel?
Go Into Your Dance is based on the rise of George White and the character of Ted Howard, from messenger boy to Broadway hoofer to Broadway producer, with a series called Town Talk, the Town Talk Review, which is loosely based on the George White scandals, and becomes quite a formidable rival to Ziegfeld, who here is called Lane. So he's also put Ziegfeld, who had, I believe, passed away in 1932, but was still very fresh in people's memories. So he's in the narrative as Lane, the impresario Lane. At the same time, though, it's not 100% biography of George White by any means, and Ropes is always kind of mixing different figures and influences and ideas. There's a lot of autobiographical influence in all of the novels, particularly his work as a vaudeville dancer. So when Ted Howard is going into vaudeville and joining up with, I think, first a pair of tango dancers, there's a lot of writing there that suggests that Ropes is drawing upon his own experiences in vaudeville, and maybe even a little bit of the partnership with Marion Hamilton once Ted teams up with a really amazing character named Nora Wayne. So maybe there's also a little bit of the Bradford and Hamilton relationship in those characters. So once again, he's taking the story of George White, but he's mixing it with all of these, I think, autobiographical ideas and memories.
It's really interesting in that regard. And he does this in all three of the novels. And some of these characters reappear.
Yes.
The Schubert brothers, what are they called?
The Wilson brothers.
The Wilson brothers. And if I'm correct, they're actually mentioned in all three of the novels.
What's really interesting, you know, when I call these three books the Backstage Trilogy, there are these connecting threads and these connecting characters. It was really surprising when I was first reading Go Into Your Dance. Oh, there's Julian Marsh. And he's producing a show called Sweet Sally that Ted auditions for and gets in as a chorus boy. And there's Andy Lee, who's the dance director of Pretty Lady in 42nd Street. And this seems to be happening in the mid-1920s. So if we're looking at a world in which Sweet Sally is happening before Pretty Lady, but he's kind of repeating character appearances. It's also striking, and I know we're waiting for Stage Mother to go back into print, but Dorothy Brock is a character in Stage Mother. So he's kind of reintroducing these characters we know from 42nd Street and weaving them throughout this Backstage trilogy. But yeah, there's also the Wilson brothers.
I love that. And that's so interesting. What do they call that in the world of superheroes?
Goodness, the Bradford Ropes cinematic universe or literary universe, perhaps.
Exactly. The Bradford Ropes literary universe is what we're seeing here.
Yes, very much so. I like the way you've put that.
You mentioned Nora, who's a fascinating character, and again, a really smart cookie.
So smart.
And probably a reference to a star we don't remember much anymore, but she was one of the biggest stars of the time. And that was who?
That was Ann Pennington. No, we don't really remember Ann Pennington so much anymore. I think she was kind of famous for her dimpled knees, right? She was a bit of a Broadway celebrity. And she was teamed with George White for quite a while, I think first in the Ziegfeld Follies.
And according to Gary Flannery, who is the expert on George White, you can listen to those episodes with Gary. She was the love of his life, is the way Gary puts it. She was the one, even though their relationship came and went, but it was continuous throughout both of their careers.
Yeah, that definitely seems like an inspiration on the relationship between Ted Howard and Nora Wayne. It's a really interesting relationship in that I'm not going to give too much away about Go Into Your Dance, you know, and how that ends, but they do have a kind of on and off relationship. And maybe, you know, Nora is kind of more into Ted more than he might deserve. He's a bit of a heel for one, but he's also a skirt chaser and doesn't necessarily want to get in a full romantic relationship with Nora, who's kind of the Girl Friday, you know, if you've seen a lot of classic films, you know, with women in that role where she's constantly bailing him out and giving him ideas and fixing his shows and has this real kind of torch burning for him the whole time. And there is a relationship. There's, you know, a long relationship as dance partners, but very much an on and off relationship that's kind of more passionate on her side than his. We kind of consistently question, does he deserve her? You know, and I think Ropes wants us to kind of question that.
Absolutely, because he does not treat Ted with any kid gloves whatsoever. He's very tough on that character.
Yeah.
I think deservedly so.
Yeah. And again, we don't know exactly how much he's drawing from George White directly. But no, he's not a particularly likable character, Ted Howard. And he is kind of ruthless and ambitious as he climbs the Broadway ladder as a producer. You know, he kind of gives Pal Joey a run for his money at times, right?
but he's characterized as a really good dancer in vaudeville before he becomes a producer. It's a really interesting novel, and not romanticizing the Ted Howard character really at all.
How does it compare in terms of, we talked about 42nd Street being really about Pretty Lady more than it is about Peggy or a central character. Is this more focused on Ted Howard as a central character, or is it again sort of painting a picture of the industry?
That's a great question. Ropes is always interested in painting the picture of the entire industry. But here we do have this real kind of story of George White breaking out of the Ziegfeld Follies and becoming a rival to, it's not the Ziegfeld Follies in the book, it's the Frivolities, it's Lane's Frivolities, right? And becoming a rival to Ziegfeld. In Go Into Your Dance, the Lane character basically blacklists him and it gets quite ugly. So we have a kind of rip from the headline story of Broadway in the 20s that Ropes is kind of putting his own spin on. So it is, again, I think focused on the industry as well, that it can be pretty cutthroat. And these impresarios can really be going at it to have the most successful review. So it's about the economics and the commerce of Broadway. And I think that shows that pretty realistically based on this real life incident of George White starting the scandals. But it's a character study too. We get Ted Howard at the center of the narrative as a really interesting character. He's very ambitious to establish himself as a Broadway showman, which he eventually does with these Town Talk reviews, which, you know, are more or less based on George White scandals. But he's ambitious. He's willing to hurt people, actually quite a bit, and literally in one production number that actually does hurt the women in the chorus. He's manipulative. He's calculating. But he's also a great dancer who is a talented Broadway showman who does have this vision and this talent to put on a show. And Nora is very much drawn to that as well. But he's an anti-hero. And the way that Ropes kind of characterizes his family background, he's a kind of working class Irish American who grows up kind of poor in the Bronx. So that kind of drives his ambition to become a great dancer and then a great Broadway producer. He has a really interesting sister named Ellen, who's also ambitious and also is kind of seeking a life beyond maybe the life her mother had, which is just drudgery in the kitchen and raising a lot of kids. Not that there's anything wrong with that, of course, but Ellen wants something else for herself and she admires Ted, her brother. She's inspired by him too. And she's somebody who wants to go into show business, but she actually ends up becoming the mistress to a series of racketeers and gangsters, which gets her in the tabloid. So there's quite a discourse in Go Into Your Dance, gossip and tabloid culture and gangster culture. So all of this is kind of being woven together by Ropes with his kind of industrial look at show business. To your question, it's a really good character study of Ted Howard, of the women in his life. I talked about Nora and her kind of holding a torch for Ted. Ellen, his sister, who's, yeah, a very, I think, three-dimensional character as well. And there's another female character who's really interesting who comes in later, a Philadelphia socialite named Eunice Goddard, and she becomes a songwriter for the Town Talk Review. So he gives us several really great character studies as focused on this anti-hero Ted. But once again, he's looking kind of more systemically at Broadway show business, at New York in the 20s, at gangster culture, and how all of these things are being kind of woven together. And I haven't even talked about a character called the Major, right, who's a gangster who ends up investing in the Town Talk Review, but only if he gets his mistress, a blues singer, a torch singer named Laura Whitney in the show. It's a really vibrant, dark, but really vibrant book to continue the Backstage trilogy.
And there are a number of gay characters as well, as there are in all three of these novels.
There are, yes.
And Ted has a journey, which you talk about in your book, this sort of journey of acceptance. He starts off very homophobic to a certain
extent.
He
does, yeah. The gay characters, once again, are really important and I think quite central to the novel. They don't get a lot of time necessarily for us to meet them, because I think as Ropes is thinking about publishing his books, he maybe only feels like he can give so much space, narrative space, to the gay characters, but they're really important. Once again, we return to the world of the Broadway chorus boy, and he gives us a pair of gay chorus boys, and that relationship is a little bit ambiguous. They're certainly great friends. They're probably on and off lovers as well, and their names are Arthur and Bobby Rogers. Bobby Rogers is a fascinating character, and he's characterized as also using she pronouns sometimes as well. So there's maybe a question of, we don't necessarily want to assume that Bobby Rogers is transgender, but the way this character is characterized, she very well could be as well. They have a very close relationship and a sad story. I don't know how much I want to talk about what happens in terms of the plot spoiler, but there is a kind of juxtaposition by Ropes of a tragedy that befalls one of these characters with the kind of rise up the show business ladder of Ted and Nora once they kind of meet on the Staten Island Ferry and team up. And there's a really incredible scene on the Staten Island Ferry. It's almost a meet cute. cute with Ted and Nora, but it's a meet cute that happens around a really macabre incident. And the way that Ropes is kind of juxtaposing the story of the heterosexual characters climbing and rising up the show business ladder, and quite, I think, more tragic incidents for the gay characters, who are also, in the time we get, characterized by their flamboyance and their wit and their really colorful characters, who do kind of open Ted's eyes to a less homophobic view of the world. When he starts in the Broadway chorus, he is very much aware that he's going to be kind of painted as one of the quote-unquote fairy chorus boys, that he doesn't want to necessarily be part of that world of gay chorus boys. But as he gets to know Arthur and Bobby Rogers, or Miss Rogers, he really is captivated by them and admires their kind of bravery, their rebellion against the homophobia around them. And he kind of comes to an admiration for them. Ropes kind of charts this journey of Ted seeing the gay characters much more as friends and as people. So once again, it's this arc. And I think you compare this, you know, maybe to Peggy in 42nd Street, speaking up against the homophobia in Broadway show business. I think Ted has a similar journey as well. Although Peggy kind of comes into it already resistant, and Ted has more of a journey into it.
No, which I think is really remarkable. And certainly in terms of your thinking about the reader, if Ropes is thinking about the reader, he's leading the reader along as well, who
yes.
may be initially wary of these gay characters.
Absolutely. I think that's very much part of Ropes' intention, that the reader, you know, presuming the reader is a heterosexual person, that they're starting to see the world more through Ted's eyes as his vision changes around these gay characters.
As you say, that amazing story on the Staten Island Ferry, I'd love to see that played out in the movie and on the stage, because it is so bizarre in a certain way, but delightful and funny and weird and sort of sad and scary all at the same time.
It is all of the tonal range he gives to this scene, the kind of macabre farce that is so funny, the wisecracks we get out of Arthur as this is happening, juxtaposed with this almost horrific circumstance. And at the same time, Ted and Nora meeting for the first time. It's an amazing sequence in this novel, and I would also love to see it dramatized.
Yeah, it's very smart writing, really writing.
Oh, yeah.
Now, speaking of dramatized, there is a movie called Go Into Your Dance, which has a character named Ted Howard, who is played.
I think they changed the name, actually.
You're right. Yeah, I forget what that is. It's been a while since I've seen that movie. But Al Jolson plays the part. It bears very little resemblance to the novel, except like so many movies from that period, when they adapt something, there'll be like 10 minutes of the movie that's, oh, that's right out of the book. But then the whole rest of the movie
is completely different. Yeah, no, some of the characters are quite loosely based on the Go Into Your Dance characters. Al Jolson plays a Broadway star instead of a kind of George White inspired hoofer turned producer. And Ruby Keeler, who he was married to, plays more or less a loose adaptation of the Nora Wayne character as well. Patsy Kelly's in there, which is always nice to see her. Helen Morgan plays the torch singer, gangster's mistress. And I think that's actually the closest thing to the book, is that there is an investing gangster and his torch singer mistress. And they seem pretty basic on the characters in the book, but a lot has been changed. So it's a pretty loose adaptation. What I remember really vividly with that is they're putting on a show, but they're turning a Broadway theater into a nightclub, kind of early immersive theater. Some of the characters are inspired by Go Into Your Dance, but the plot's quite different as well, starting with the kind of transformation of the Ted Howard character, that we're no longer really looking at the George White story. And the fact that Ropes was not involved in this film adaptation, as far as I can tell.
It's disappointing if you want to see the novel played out.
Right, right.
But like any movie from that period, it's got some fascinating elements. And one interesting thing is the song Go Into Your Dance, which was written for that movie, will end up in the stage musical of 42nd Street.
It did, in a quite different context, yes.
Exactly. The circles keep going.
Yes, very much so.
If you've a melancholy case of the blues, I got a remedy for you. If you've an ounce of rhythm down in your shoes, then I'll change your point of view. If you've been singing a sad and blue song,
go into your dance
until you learn how to sing a new song.
Go into your dance. Don't be complaining.
Learn how to smile.
And it's a training.
Dance in the rain a while.
Put off your sorrow until tomorrow. Go into your dance.
Don't go away. Broadway Nation will be back right after this quick break.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, this is David Armstrong, and it's my great pleasure to welcome Factor as a sponsor to Broadway Nation this week. This spring, you can eat stress-free with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. You can choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or my personal choice, Vegan and Veggie. You can also discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunches, snacks, and beverages that'll help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day long. What are you waiting for? Get started today and get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals so you can get back to doing what you love this spring. If you're looking for gourmet meals, try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. These are no-fuss, no-muss meals, and Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. And you can tailor it all to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. And you can pause or reschedule the deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. And we're celebrating Earth Day all month long at Factor, so look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. Here's what you do. Head to factormeals.com/BN50 and use code BN50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box. That's code BN50, as in Broadway Nation, BN50 at factormeals.com/BN50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Do it now.
I hate to put you on the spot, but I will. Of these three novels, which one speaks the most to you? Which one did you enjoy? Which do you find the most interesting? Do you find the most rich?
I love all three so much. You're putting me on the spot, only in that it's such a hard question. 42nd Street is the first. It's incredible in so many ways. I also recently took another look at Go Into Your Dance, and I just love the boldness with which Ropes is giving us this anti-hero protagonist, Ted Howard, but also the really, I think, rich and independent and varied female characters that we get. Nora, who's so street smart and so very sharp, although she might be a little bit in over her head with Ted, and Ellen, and the songwriting Eunice Goddard. So I love his female characters in that. If I had to choose one absolute favorite, it's the one that you can't get. It's Stage Mother, perhaps, just because I think in 42nd Street, Ropes had given us another stage mother named Mrs. Blair, who's desperate to get her young daughter, who's a toe dancer, into Pretty Lady, which she eventually does. And that stage mother is a little more of a negative depiction of a stage mother. In Kitty Lorraine, we do get this kind of proto Mama Rose, this really ruthless stage mother character who's really willing to go to any lengths to make her daughter Shirley a star. But Ropes depicts Kitty Lorraine, I think, with such psychological complexity and nuance and an eye to the ways in which this woman becomes the archetype of the stage mother through an industry that's rife with ageism and sexism and misogyny, and the idea of that this woman is trying to do her best for her daughter in a show business world in which men have all of the power, right? So I think it's a quite feminist novel. It's not without its flaws from a 21st century perspective, perhaps. Also, Dorothy Brock is a character in Stage Mother, and the way Ropes puts her into these themes is really interesting. So if I had to answer your question, I really love what Ropes does with the kind of figure of his title, Stage Mother, the character of Jack Thomas. So once again, there's a depiction of gay men, gay dancers on Broadway, but there's a really barbed critique against what Ropes perceived as a really, at times, quite misogynistic industry. So I like Stage Mother.
You mentioned themes, and you've discovered or you identify a number of themes that run through these books, through the trilogy. And one of them that I know that you spend some time talking about, which I thought was really interesting, is just the old showbiz motto that the show must go on. And this plays out in various ways throughout this trilogy.
Yes, very much so. I think that's one of the things that feels so timely when you go back to these three novels. In that Ropes, he's in love with the smell of grease paint. He loves theater so much. It's really the vitality of his love for theater animates all of these novels. But that doesn't mean he's not critical of what he saw as harmful myth of the show must go on at any cost. So we have scenes repeatedly in his novels where he's questioning that myth, that if an actor is sick or in harm's way, that the show should still go on. And again, I don't know how much I can talk about this without giving too many plot spoilers, but in 42nd Street, there's a scene that was cut from the film in which an elderly actor has a heart attack out of town during an out-of-town dress rehearsal and collapses and dies on stage. And the way Ropes depicts the fallout of that is quite, I think, critical of some of these myths. In the two other novels as well, we get scenes where he's questioning or critiquing the myth of the show must go on as well. We talked about Go Into Your Dance, and there's a quite disastrous production number that happens, I'm sure you recall, in Go Into Your Dance, where the chorus girls are harmed by Ted Howard's negligence.
And by his ambition,
by
to
his
a great
ambition.
Extent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. He's wants more, and it backfires.
The more, right. He's determined to have the biggest number, the splashiest review, and the most successful review. The cost to that, he overlooks the warnings of his stage manager. And really, some really bad things happen. And Ropes depicts that really in a really darkly vivid way in Go Into Your Dance as well. It's a quite unforgettable scene, and it happens against this like Wisteria time number. So he's also kind of, you know, at the same time poking fun, as he likes to do, at some of the kind of sentimental cliches around 20s musical comedy. But yeah, in all of the novels, there are scenes, you know, where he's critical of the show must go on. At the same time, you know, he truly loved theater and show business and musical comedy. And I think he wanted the industry to rise to its full potential in terms of keeping everybody safe and well.
And I think he also really gets into the ambivalence of it as well, because I think a lot of people in show business, at least I can speak for myself, feel both things at the same time. The show must go on.
Yeah.
I've used this example many times, but there was a time period where we had a huge snowstorm in Seattle during the holiday time at the Fifth Avenue Theater, which I was running at the time. We figured out how to keep people in hotel rooms downtown, how to keep the orchestra in hotel rooms, how to keep everybody there so that we could continue to do the show in the middle of the snowstorm.
Right.
The whole city was shut down, but 300 people showed up to see the show. There was no way you could contact all those people
to
tell them that the show wasn't going to be on. And to me, that's why the show has to go on, because people are going to come to see it.
Oh, yeah.
It's
I think
the
he's
audience.
Very aware of the ambivalence of that. We see that in the film version of 42nd Street and the stage musical so much, that all of these people's lives and work are hanging on that the show has to go on, that Peggy has to go on. For Brocker, all of these people are out of work. And sometimes, you know, the show, the sacrifice really is worth it, because there are so many reasons to go on at the show. And I think Ropes sees all of that too. But I think the critique comes in when it really, when somebody's safety is in danger. So he does
obviously
see
their limits.
Yeah,
there are two sides to it. Exactly.
Right,
yeah.
Right. But it's fascinating, I think, having some of these conversations over the last couple of years with everything that's happened. But I think, yeah,
totally.
Ropes also shows all sides of it. And there are certainly reasons to just make sure the show goes on.
And it struck me that it relates to the most famous story about the Broadway version of 42nd Street, which is, of course, the opening night and Gower Champion dying and David Merrick keeping it a secret
for a whole day. Yeah.
And being greatly criticized for that by many people. But in my mind, it was always, well, that's exactly what Gower Champion would have wanted
him
to do.
Right, absolutely. Yeah.
Because he would come from that old school mentality of, you're not going to screw up the opening night because I'm dead. We're going to do an opening night.
There are so many stories around that opening night and what happened and the secrecy of what Merrick did around Gower Champion's death earlier in the day and the opening night announcement. But I think you're right. It's hard to speak for any member of that creative team, but that Gower Champion had put so much of his passion into that show.
It's a fascinating because it's so complex.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which leads us to your final chapter of the book, which you call Bringing Back Bradford Ropes, which gives us the story of Bradford Ropes, the time period when he dies, which is right around the same time as the nostalgia craze is starting to come together, at least the beginnings of that with Dames at Sea. So many things that were inspired by 42nd Street start to come back into the culture at that time.
Yeah.
Talk just a little bit about that and the irony of that. He didn't live to see most of that.
He did not. So Bradford Ropes died in 1966. The timing of that is interesting for a number number of reasons. 1964, he dies 2 years after the publication of Susan Sontag's Notes on Camp, which I think is quite important in the nostalgia revival as well, and the rediscovery of Busby Berkeley's movies. And that whole kind of rediscovery movement of the Berkeley films also takes place right around that time in the mid-60s as well, but Ropes doesn't really live to see it. 1969 is, of course, also the year of the Stonewall Uprising. Ropes doesn't really get to live into the modern era of the gay rights, gay liberation movement as well, which also kind of plays a role in the nostalgia craze too. In the 70s, we get these revivals all of a sudden. Dames at Sea starts off Broadway at the Cafe Chino and then becomes a smash hit at the Bowery Lane Theater as well.
And Dames at Sea is a paraphrase of 42nd Street.
It is very much a paraphrase.
The movie of 42nd Street.
Yeah. 42nd Street, but also a bit of Gold Diggers of 1933, but it's a pastiche, right, of 42nd Street and other Busby Berkeley films. And that is a really important show in that nostalgia craze. Then there's No No Nanette, I think, is it 71? Is
that one?
Yeah, 1971 becomes a huge surprise hit on Broadway with Busby Berkeley not actually choreographing, supervising, actually, but really being kind of at the forefront of that production as well, which
sort
also
of
is the
figurehead.
The figurehead,
exactly.
Very much so. And Ruby Keeler.
Ruby Keeler, center stage.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's Ruby Keeler's big comeback in No No Nanette. By then, the Busby Berkeley revival is well underway. But Ropes doesn't really live into that. And it's interesting to think, if he had lived a few years longer, would that have led to a discovery of his work? Would he have stepped up into the limelight again? Because he was not terribly fond of claiming all the credit for himself and was generally a pretty modest person. I like to think that if he had lived longer, he maybe wouldn't have fallen into such obscurity.
I think that's right, especially because the work that he inspired came so much into the center of the culture. And because gay visibility had broken through to such a great extent at that point, I think then his novels would have been rediscovered, because you would say, wait, look what's in this novel that we forgot was there. Certainly there would have been a spread in After Dark magazine or one of, you know, the kind of things that were
focused
on.
I think he would have loved
that.
I don't think he would have wanted his family to know about it.
And that's the kind of thing that After Dark magazine did at the time, mm-hmm. was rediscover and revive these figures from the past.
Right.
So, you know, who knows? That's all pie.
It's all speculation.
We'll never know. But, all speculation.
But I think if he lived a few years longer, it could have changed the course of how we think about Bradford Ropes.
And that nostalgia craze, that rediscovery of those movies and the celebration of Busby Berkeley, which is a little wistful because he becomes the figurehead of 42nd Street and Bradford Ropes is nowhere to be found in that discussion at the time. But, you know, it's understandable. Busby Berkeley was still around. But it's kind of ironic in a way that this straight artist becomes the face of these movies of this period in this era where the gay artist who really inspired it all has been forgotten.
Absolutely. And if you go back right to Sontag's Notes on Camp, she cites Berkeley as like a pure example of naive camp. So he becomes kind of very associated not only with the nostalgia craze, the nostalgia movement, but also this camp aesthetic. I found an interview with Berkeley where he was asked what camp is or what his impression of camp. And it's anybody who does something interesting and unique and goes to the top, right? He wasn't particularly somebody who was that well-versed in gay culture, as much as his films became so central to gay culture as well, and the nostalgia craze. And then Ropes, by then, nobody's thinking about Bradford Ropes and his gay themes and his kind of camp style. And it all kind of gets put on Berkeley. And again, I love Busby Berkeley, and I don't have 42nd Street without Busby Berkeley and the great songs of Warren and Dubin. But by then, Ropes isn't even in the conversation.
Absolutely. And an adaptation of Ropes' novel without those elements would probably just be another movie from the 30s as opposed to this iconic thing that then inspired a whole series of movies.
Yes.
42nd Street goes on into five other movies. Again, talk about the, what was the expression we used earlier? The cinematic, what do we say in terms of Marvel things? You said it.
Well, I had said the Bradford Ropes literary universe, but of course we get also a Busby Berkeley cinematic universe.
Exactly. That whole string of Gold Diggers films.
33, 35, 37, I think in Paris. Yeah.
Footlight Parade.
Mm-hmm. Footlight Parade.
And they all have recurring, not so much characters, but recurring actors. And it's like a rep company of actors.
Yes. I love the Warner Brothers musical Rep Company. Yeah.
Exactly. So fun. That will eventually lead to the Broadway musical 42nd Street, the tail end of the nostalgia craze. And I was fascinated, you quote some other authors who've talked about this as well, you know, the world shifts with the Reagan era, and 42nd Street is right there. I think you say that it corresponds exactly with Reagan's presidency. Talk a little bit about that. Whereas the movie and maybe Bradford Ropes' novels as well sort of represent the New Deal and a very liberal sense of politics. Mm-hmm. Now we turn the same story around and it sort of becomes a Reagan era fable.
Well, 42nd Street, the Broadway musical, does more or less coincide with the two terms of the Reagan era. You know, the inception of 42nd Street, Carter is still in office and, you know, there's a recession. So it does start before Reagan, but they do overlap quite a bit. So I talk about that in the book in terms of how 42nd Street is kind of reflecting the economics and politics of the Reagan era in some ways. And I think that affects very much what can be done in terms of the gay themes and characters as well. There is certainly gay theater on Broadway during the Reagan era as well. And we have to also go back to shows like A Chorus Line too for putting gay characters in musicals. But it still wasn't that common or mainstream when you think about the adaptation choices that were perhaps available to Stewart and Bramble and their collaborators. And they, I think, went for a different approach, right? It is kind of a fable and a love letter to Broadway in a way that the Ropes novel is quite grittier. And this had already happened with the 1933 film. We've lost Jack Winslow and we've lost kind of the gay themes, which continues in the 1980 adaptation as well. So I think there are quite a few ways in which this is a show of the Reagan era. It's a fantastic show as well. And the staging by Gower Champion is so legendary and
sensational.
Sensational.
I was at the very first preview of 42nd Street on Broadway. It was at that time when they were postponing the previews because David Merrick was obsessed that the press was going to sneak in and see it. There was a rat in the boiler room was one of his quotes, why he wasn't opening the show and why they kept delaying the previews. And I was friends with Leroy Reams at the time. And I got a call that afternoon saying, come down to the theater. We're going to do a show tonight. And so there are only about 300 people got these calls and knew about it. That very first preview was just 300 people
amazing.
The Winter Garden Theater to see the first preview after they'd been rehearsing. They'd been running the show for like 3 weeks because they were supposed to have previewed days earlier. So that was a very exciting, very amazing experience. The book of the show, which famously got trimmed way down to just being credited as...
Lead-ins and crossovers by.
Lead-ins and crossovers by. That billing has changed since then, but was the barest hint of a book that you could possibly have to tell that story. It's interesting because the show then becomes almost a review of these great musical numbers.
Right. A kind of proto-jukebox musical, if you will.
Exactly. And just enough story just to tie it all together. It's interesting how the progression of this whole, if you go from novel to movie to Dames at Sea to all the other variations which you talk about in your book.
Yeah, there was also the Ken Russell version of The Boyfriend as another
which
kind
is
of spin
exactly
on 42nd
another
Street.
Paraphrase of 42nd
paraphrase,
Street.
Yeah.
And then you reminded me that there was that movie called Movie
the Stanley Donen
that had,
right.
What was that sequence
Baxter's
called?
Baxter's Beauties.
Baxter's Beauties. I'd totally forgotten about that. I saw that at the time. And that was another mini version of 42nd
right,
Street
right.
Or paraphrase.
So it's become ubiquitous in the culture as this kind of like quintessential backstage myth. But by then, we've just lost Ropes from it.
Very interesting. Sum all this up for us. I know that's such an easy thing to do. After how many years of research did you do on this?
6 years altogether of the research itself. The love for the novels goes back quite a bit longer as well, but 6 years.
Talk us just a little bit about the logistics of that. What was available to you? What did you have to dig out? What was completely missing that you discovered?
So much was missing. I could spend a really long time talking about what felt sometimes like a kind of detective search and kind of unlocking clues and just how it all came together. So it was really an amazing journey once I got the idea that I needed to find a way of telling the biography of this wonderful writer, forgotten writer. I started in his hometown. Libraries. I started at the Thomas Crane Library in Quincy, Massachusetts, his hometown, sitting in the dark with microfilm and finding issues of the Quincy Patriot Ledger, which was his local paper, where he was ri- written up quite a bit. We don't find a lot of Ropes necessarily in the New York Times and some of the bigger national papers, but his local paper liked to talk about him. So I started with the microfilm of old Quincy Patriot Ledger issues. And at some point I learned about the stage name. So once I learned that he had performed under the stage name of Billy Bradford, suddenly a lot more material became available because you'll only find a small part of the story under Bradford Ropes from certain years. For a good 10 years, he's Billy Bradford. And so I also went on all kinds of searches in terms of ancestry and ancestry.com. Did some work in Quincy. I visited the Thayer Academy, wonderful hospitality there, and just seeing where he went to prep school. I went to the classroom where he liked to act out plays. And so just kind of seeing where he grew up. So all kinds of research, some quite unconventional, went into it too. And I located a relative who was very generous with her time and the materials she shared as well. So all of these things kind of came together over the course of 6 years to form an increasingly, by no means complete, you know, of course, a lot is still elusive, but an increasingly full and vivid picture of the biography of Bradford Ropes. So it was an incredible journey, and I'm grateful to have found as much as I did, in part because I had great people and librarians and relatives helping me.
Well, and you were just diligent in your sleuthing to ferret it all out. Was there one particular piece of information that you just remember the day it was so thrilling to discover that?
That happened quite a few times. I'll tell you what I discovered that I want to maybe go back to. I found textual evidence, just by what I know about his biography and his life story, that I believe he was a ghostwriter on the screenplay of The Gold Diggers of 1933. And if I'd been able to complete that part of the detective search, I had hoped to go out to LA to the Warner Brothers archives to look at screenplays. One of the exciting discoveries is when I found his signature for the first time in his handwriting, and to see if I could go into the archives and see if there was any of his handwriting on screenplay drafts. But there's quite a bit of evidence just textually to suggest he puts like names of family members and biographical details. If you watch Gold Diggers of 1933, you remember the Dick Powell character changes his name from Robert Treat Bradford, a kind of Boston Brahmin, and changes his name as he becomes a songwriter named Brad Roberts. And if we compare that to Billy Bradford and Bradford Ropes, just the name. But there's a couple of like places and names that are quite specific to his family history. I had hoped to kind of complete that search to prove definitively my conviction. I have a strong feeling that he might have been involved in Gold Diggers of 1933. He was in Hollywood and they rushed it into production right after 42nd Street had become such a smash hit.
Yeah, you mentioned that in the book, and certainly that character seems like it's based on him, if nothing else.
Yeah, I think there's certainly a basis on his life story. I couldn't prove conclusively during those 6 years that he might have been a ghostwriter. But at the very least, I think he's somewhere in there. And maybe the screenwriters were...
They were just working across the hall from each other or something.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he's in there somewhere. Yeah. He's in there somewhere.
Fascinating. Thank you, Maya Cantu. It has been so great to talk to you about your really amazing book, Grease Paint Puritan, Boston to 42nd Street in the Queer Backstage Novels of Bradford Ropes. Fascinating. I enjoyed really so many aspects of reading this book because it touches on so many different worlds.
Thank you so much, David. I'm so happy you enjoyed the book and all the work that went into it. And it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. And thank you for your enthusiasm and insight into Ropes. I've really enjoyed this.
Likewise. It's been so much fun. Thank you again. When you find out that new information, we'll have you back and you can maybe you can break it here on Broadway Nation.
Let's plan on it. Thank you, David.
Come and meet those dancing feet on the avenue I'm taking you to, 42nd Street. Hear the beat of dancing feet. It's the song I love, the melody of 42nd Street. Little nifties from the 50s, innocent and sweet. Sexy ladies from the 80s who are indiscreet. They're side by side, they're glorified. Where the underworld can meet the elite. Naughty. Street.
here's the information about how you too can become a patron of Broadway Nation. A donation of just $7 a month will not only keep Broadway Nation rolling along, it will also provide you with exclusive access to the complete unedited versions of many of the interviews that you hear on this podcast. And all patrons will receive special shout-outs and acknowledgments of your vital support for Broadway Nation. To join, simply go to broadwaynationpodcast.supercast.tech. That's broadwaynationpodcast.supercast.tech. Or click the link in the show notes to this episode. Broadway Nation is written and produced by me, David Armstrong. Special thanks to Pals Mox for his help with editing this episode, and to the entire team at the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.